characterizations of him and that CNN's conduct is intended to interfere with his political career. In particular, Donald Trump argues that he's entitled to hundreds of millions of dollars in punitive damages because of CNN's use of the term "the big lie" to describe Trump's stated concerns about the integrity of the election process for the 2020 presidential election. Trump's lawyers say that the big lie is a direct reference to a tactic employed by Adolf Hitler and appearing in Hitler's book Mein Kampf. If you tell a big lie enough and keep repeating it, people will eventually come to believe it, Trump's lawyers stated, noting it was used by Hitler to generate hatred against Jews and to justify their genocide. The lawsuit says CNN's campaign of dissuasion in the form of libel and slander against Donald Trump has only escalated in recent months as CNN fears he will run for president in 2024. The former president has been claiming since November of 2020 that the election was rigged, despite dozens of lawsuits and recounts that found it was not. He is being investigated by Congress and the U.S. government for trying to overturn the election results. And 2 years later, he still claims that he won the 2020 presidential election. The case has been assigned to Trump-appointed judge Raj Singhal in the Southern District of Florida. Britain's Guardian newspaper tells us more about the same story. Donald Trump has sued cable television network CNN, claiming defamation and seeking punitive damages of $475 million, according to a Florida court filing on Monday, 3rd of October. The U.S. cable news station has attempted to smear the former U.S. president with a series of ever more scandalous, false and defamatory labels of racist, Russian lackey, insurrectionist, and ultimately Hitler, Trump's lawyers claimed. The lawsuit has been filed in federal court in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Beyond simply highlighting any negative information about the plaintiff and ignoring all positive information about him, CNN has sought to use its massive influence, purportedly as a trusted news source, to defame the plaintiff in the minds of its viewers and readers, for the purpose of defeating him politically, the court filing states. Donald Trump claimed that CNN has used its considerable influence as a leading news organization to defeat him politically. Trump, a Republican, claims in the 29-page lawsuit that CNN had a long track record of criticizing him but had ramped up its attacks in recent months because the network feared that he would run again for president in 2024. As a part of its concerted effort to tilt the political balance to the left, CNN has tried to taint the plaintiff, the lawsuit says. The lawsuit lists several instances in which CNN appeared to compare Donald Trump to Adolf Hitler, including a January 2022 special report by CNN host Fareed Zakaria that included footage of the 20th century German dictator. Trump, who in 2020 lost a re-election effort to Democrat Joe Biden, has not said officially whether he will seek re-election again in 2024, though he has dropped many such hints. The lawsuit comes as a 76-year-old former president faces considerable legal woes, including a criminal investigation by the U.S. Department of Justice for retaining government records at his Mar-a-Lago estate in Florida, after leaving office in January of 2021. Donald Trump was sued last month by the New York State Attorney General Letitia James, who has accused him of lying to banks and insurers about the value of his assets. And a congressional committee and the Department of Justice are separately investigating last year's 6th of January 2021 assault on the U.S. Capitol by Trump supporters. We'll be right back.
the wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has severely censured the unrest that erupted in some parts of Iran following the death of a young woman, stating that the deadly riots were orchestrated in advance by the United States and the Israeli regime. Ayatollah Khamenei made the comment in an address to military cadets in Tehran, saying he was saddened by the death of a young woman, which triggered the riots. Protests over the death of Mahsa Amini, a 22-year-old Iranian woman who fainted at a police station and was later pronounced dead at a hospital, erupted first in her native province of Kurdistan and later spread to other parts of the country, including Tehran. The leader said reactions to the incident were not normal. The riots were not natural, as groups of people caused social disturbances on the streets, burned copies of the Holy Quran, harassed veiled women, and set mosques, religious congregational halls, and private cars on fire. According to a statement released by the Iranian intelligence ministry, the rioters have been backed by Western regimes and their mercenary media, who disseminated misinformation and distorted the sequence of events that led to Amini's death, even before the official investigation into the incident concludes. Also, the intelligence ministry said 9 people from Germany, Poland, Italy, France, the Netherlands, Sweden, and other countries have been arrested for their role in the riots. From the very beginning, different Western media began a campaign against Iran voicing support for the rioters. That's why they have remained silent for years about the strict sanctions imposed on Iran. Meanwhile, a teenage girl named Zainab Essa Majid al-Khazali was killed during American military drills near a U.S. military camp close to the international airport in the Iraqi capital Baghdad. There was an effective blackout on the death in Western media. So why are they refusing to show the same sensibility about Zainab's death? Seemingly, what matters most is creating turmoil in the stable nations in West Asia. Shortly after the death of Mahsa Amini, allegations of mistreatment and even torture surfaced on social media platforms, and Western media outlets lost no time in picking up the story and willfully distorting it. Before any official statement was made, Iran was accused of deliberate killing, and Mahsa was brutally killed by Iranian police was the talk of the town. Unsurprisingly, these headlines come as part of a systematic campaign to attack Iran and cause turmoil in the country.
There have been more anti-government protests in the Iranian capital, Tehran.
Just a moment ago, protests spreading in the country of Iran over the death of a young woman earlier this month.
The protests in Iran.
In addition, for years, the West, particularly the United States, has been trying to stop Iran's progress by using economic sanctions, military threats, cyber attacks, and assassinations. In his remarks, Ayatollah Khamenei said the U.S. and its allies' main problem is a strong and independent Iran and the country's progress. He pointed to the country's progress in all sectors, efforts aimed at facilitating domestic production, activation of knowledge-based companies, and the country's ability to neutralize Western sanctions. The leader said that enemies are gravely mistaken in their calculations, and their plots will not yield anything at all. And he's right. Iranians once again foiled the enemy's plots after huge crowds of people took to the streets across Iran to denounce acts of vandalism and desecration of Islamic sanctities by rioters, sending a strong message that Iran's security and stability is the most important issue.
When it comes to the relationship between the EU and Israel, one thing is evident. The EU comes out defending Palestinians and condemns Israel for its different violations, from settlements to the killing of Palestinians. But words of condemnations are just that, words. For when it comes to doing anything about it, it does absolutely nothing. There is a broad consensus that the EU is not an honest broker when it comes to Israel and Palestine, and that the very DNA of the Israel-EU relationship reveals that on Palestinian rights, Brussels only condemns Israeli illegal acts. Be it in response to the unfounded allegations in the 2021 dossier, which offered no proof to justify the terror label for Palestinian groups, or to the all-frequent military onslaught on Gaza, the EU has done little to hold Israel accountable besides ritual but ineffectual expressions of concern. In fact, the EU recently reiterated its commitment to developing closer diplomatic ties and agreed to resume meetings of the EU-Israel Association Council. Another sign of Europe's somewhat covert support for Israel is a memorandum of understanding between the EU, Egypt, and Israel, where Cairo is set to export Israeli gas to Europe. All this has also shed light on the West's double standards regarding the Palestine-Israel conflict, and this has only been further clarified through the West's support of Ukraine in light of the Russian special military operation there. The world rallied behind Ukraine and left Palestinians frustrated, who witnessed being criminalized and were constantly being told that they don't have the right to resist, or even labeled as terrorists or anti-Semites just for asking for their rights. Despite the long list of horrific human rights violations in Palestine and other atrocities in the world, the West is yet to display a unified response to the Israeli aggressions. But what makes matters worse is the West claims it supports human rights, like for Palestinians, yet continues to do nothing when it comes to the Israeli violations of Palestinian rights. In 2021, Manu Pineda, the chair of the European Parliament delegation for relations with Palestine, stated that Israel has inflicted brutal violence against Palestinians in Al-Quds who were resisting their forced displacement, so settlers can take their place, adding that this is part of Israel's ongoing attempts to erase the Palestinian presence from the city. But what he said further shows how the EU is actually funding the Israeli violations against Palestinians. He said the EU cannot continue to have an association agreement with Israel and called on the bloc to move to terminate it. This showed that the EU money was being used to fund entities and illegal settlements and to subsidize Israel's arms industry. Yet, in action, none of those promises were kept. Palestinians have been, in essence, ripped off of their rights and been subject to ethnic cleansing, occupation, and oppression for over 7 decades now, and the double standard and hypocrisy shown by the West, especially the EU, only demonstrates that fighting military aggression as well as fighting for rights and how it's approached towards or labeled is solely dependent on the identity of the aggressor with no regard to the tragic consequences. So in short, the EU may condemn Israeli acts of violation, but it truly supports Israel. Gaza is under a blockade by Israel, which claims it is the only way to confront the Palestinian resistance who hold power in the area. EU Foreign Policy Chief Joseph Borrell explained that there is no solution to the West Asia conflict without a very strong commitment on part of the US. Many attempts were made in the past, but at the moment there appears to be no path forward. Such reactions, however, aren't new to Palestinians, as they have on multiple occasions seen the EU and even the UN condemning Israeli actions, including warnings over the mass displacement of Palestinians, but no actions to prevent it. The EU says it supports Palestinians, but continues to further strengthen its ties both politically and economically with Israel. And this only proves that it is not an honest or effective stakeholder in the struggle for Palestinian sovereignty and independence. Its actions have so far only allowed Israel to continue its acts of aggression with complete impunity.
When it comes to the Nord Stream pipeline sabotage, a fourth leak has been found. That was enough for a Security Council meeting to take place. But at the end of the session, Russia was blamed for the act of sabotage. Russia and the West are trading blame over this. Although Russia has not accused the US by name, all of its statements are pointing the finger at the US. The same goes for the US and the EU. Both have stopped short of directly accusing Russia. Russia has said that the US president is obliged to answer the question of whether the US carried out its threat.
If Russia invades, that means tanks or troops crossing the border of Ukraine again, then there will be no longer a Nord Stream 2. We will bring an end to it.
How will you do that exactly, since the project and control of the project is within Germany's control?
We will, I promise you, we'll be able to do it.
Meanwhile, Washington also dismissed the suggestion and accused Russia of spreading disinformation. While the EU has said the sabotage was deliberate, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said it would be in no one's interest if the leaks were caused deliberately. But Blinken's point that it would be in no one's interest can be argued otherwise. In the case of the U.S., it would reap huge benefits. For example, it would continue selling gas to the EU and make huge profits. Some single shipments are bringing in $200 million U.S. for the U.S. The U.S. is now sending 60% of its liquefied natural gas exports to Europe, up from less than 20% this time a year ago. Meanwhile, the high gas and electricity prices are pushing European manufacturers to shift to the U.S. This is because there are relatively stable prices in there, with green energy incentives also luring the companies to the U.S. The U.S. has recently adopted Inflation Reduction Act, makes it a particularly attractive destination for companies in the chemicals, batteries, and green energy sectors. It aims to increase manufacturing and level the international playing field by using American incentives to match the competition from overseas. But what about the other parties that are related to Russia's Nord Stream pipeline, namely Russia and the EU? Would either benefit from the act of sabotage on the pipeline? The answer is a resounding no in the case of the EU. In Europe, more and more companies are switching into survival mode. For a lot of them, the time is coming to renew their electricity supply contracts with utilities. And thanks to the energy inflation, these are set to be much higher than the contracts for the current year. Meanwhile, the European Commission has promised to help by capping the revenues of oil, gas, and coal companies. As for Russia, it would lose income, so that would also be ruled out. Russia has said that Europe is now indefinitely deprived of key gas supply routes. It said that it is searching for ways to get the pipelines up and running, but the timeline cannot yet be estimated. So the big winner from the energy crisis in Europe would be the US. Europe's descent into deindustrialization is happening at warp speed. With the sabotage of the Nord Stream pipeline, there is no way back. Europe can no longer import Russian gas, and this means that prices will remain high until Europe builds more energy capacity, and this could take years. High energy prices will, in essence, make European manufacturing uncompetitive. After all, European manufacturers will be forced to pass the higher energy cost to the end user or the consumers. And that is how many European businesses will begin to unravel. According to one analyst, the only logical European response to the threat of widespread deindustrialization is to raise tariffs. This is the only way to balance out prices between more expensive European goods and cheaper foreign goods. One of the consequences, however, is that it will lower living standards, depriving Europeans of cheaper priced goods. In short, this no longer looks like a short-term crisis for Europe. Stories from Europe are like stories once heard in countries that are suffering from high inflation and resource rations imposed by the state. European companies or factories moving to the US would help the US economic situation. The US is already suffering from high inflation and an energy crunch. The relocation of European manufacturers to the United States will give the US a big advantage by boosting investment and creating jobs. It will also strengthen the country's industrial economy. This will also give the United States a bigger advantage in the face of its increasing military and economic confrontation with China. And in the face of rising competition with Russia and China, having Europe on its side will prove to be a big advantage for the United States. The question is whether the Biden administration knowingly nudged Europe to decouple from Russian energy sources in order to lure European companies toward the influence sphere of Washington.
The wait was finally over. The four regions of Ukraine are not Ukrainian territory any longer, but Russian territory, after referendums were held.
Of course, there were soldiers, but it was not because of forcing the people, but it was to protect us, and not for the people to force them to vote.
It's perfectly understandable, and on the democratic point of view, I don't see anything to say against this referendum.
The residents overwhelmingly voted to join Russia. This was the fight of their lives, said the leader of Donetsk. 3,000 days of fighting, thousands killed due to Ukraine's shelling. Now, lives will be saved. The US, the UK, and the West in general already spoke out against these referendums, which they called a sham.
Russia and sham referenda and annexations that seem to be proceeding in Ukraine. One, we've been very clear that we are prepared and we will impose additional severe and swift costs on Russia for proceeding with the annexations.
The UK Prime Minister Liz Truss was visibly angry at Russia's formalization. Putin cannot be allowed to alter international borders using brute force. We will ensure that he loses this illegal war. For Russia, this was a big moment. First, it was successful in building a wall that almost entirely blocked NATO's eastward expansion. This would almost make Ukraine a landlocked country, posing another major challenge for Ukraine and the US. The Russian President Vladimir Putin's formalization of the referendums, however, more than just that. He took the opportunity to slam the West, the US in particular, from different angles, including cultural values. At the same time, Putin called on Kiev to return to negotiations, emphasizing, however, that Moscow will not discuss the choice made by the Donbas republics, Kherson, and Zaporizhzhia. This poses the question, is Putin open for peace talks in order to end the war? This is a question that the West, in particular the US and the US-backed NATO, need to wrestle with. After all, they have put all their cards in on this conflict. Looking at the US assistance that Ukraine has received, the US tops the list, with the UK coming in second. But other countries have also contributed quite a bit militarily to this war. Are they now willing to settle for a negotiated solution? A former Pentagon and CIA official has said that one theory is that Putin, aware that his military is struggling mightily against the stiff Ukrainian resistance, might use the sham boats to claim the mission is accomplished and send his troops home. This might not sit well with the West, since this, in a sense, is a declaration of a win by Putin. Yet the economic crises gripping Europe might be overwhelming for European countries, forcing them to capitulate and say enough is enough, and to opt for a compromise solution before the citizens of the countries rise up against them or protest like they did in France.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com, /EN.
From our imams, the ninth imam is the first, whose imamate began at a very young age, about 8 or 9.
As-salamu alayka ya Abu Ja'far, Muhammad ibn Ali, al-Barakah.
Peace be upon you, O Abu Ja'far, Muhammad, the son of Ali, the righteous, the pious.
This is Dialogue, a program on the famous conversations of Imam Muhammad ibn Ali al-Jawad alayhi salam. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. I'm your host Mahdi, and we're talking about the dialogues of Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam. Imam Muhammad ibn Ali al-Jawad alayhi salam was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, and he was the ninth divinely appointed imam among the household of the Holy Prophet. He was the testamentary trustee and the ninth successor to the Holy Prophet Muhammad. He was also the testamentary trustee and the only successor of the eighth divinely appointed imam, Imam Ali ibn Musa al-Ridha alayhi salam. Scholars, jurisprudents, narrators of traditions, and learners of wisdom and sciences came to Imam al-Jawad to drink from the pure fountain of his sciences and cultures. Jurisprudents have reported much from Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam concerning the various verdicts of the Islamic Sharia, worships, mu'amalat, the different business dealings, and other branches of jurisprudence, and all have been recorded in the encyclopedias of jurisprudence and hadith.
Parts of Ziyarah texts of Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam. Peace be upon you, O shining lights. Peace be upon you, O rising full moon. Peace be upon you, O pure one from among the pure ones. Peace be upon you, O immaculate from among the immaculate ones. Peace be upon you, O pleased and pure. Peace be upon you, O Abu Ja'far, Muhammad, the son of Ali, the righteous, the pious, the faithful leader, and Allah's mercy and blessings be upon you.
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's great to have you with us. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. So, dear friends, we're talking about the dialogues of the ninth divinely appointed Imam, Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam. In one such dialogue, we find that Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam was asked about the names and the attributes of Allah. Some philosophers and theologians had gathered around and had asked the following question from the esteemed Imam. They asked, "Tell us about the Exalted Lord. He has names and attributes in his book, the Quran. Are these names and attributes equal to Allah?" Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam replied, "If you say that the names and attributes are a divisible thing that separates and or unites, then it is not possible to say that Allah is united, nor is he many or few, but rather Allah is the God in His essence, and whatever other than the One is indivisible, and Allah is the One that is indivisible. And whatever other than the One is divisible, and Allah is the One that is indivisible. Allah is not thought to be many or few, much or little. Every divisible thing is thought to be many or few, and is a creature that has a creator. You're saying that Allah has power over all things means that nothing at all fails Allah. Allah is not said to be unable, but all other than Allah are unable. And also you're saying that Allah is aware means that you deny ignorance from Allah and ascribe ignorance to all other than Allah. And if Allah annihilates things, He annihilates graphs and spellings. He does not end and still exists who has still been aware. In this beautiful dialogue and this description of Imam Al-Jawad alayhi salam regarding Tawheed and Islamic monotheism, we truly begin to fathom the great amount of knowledge and wisdom and depth that Imam Al-Jawad alayhi salam has. The depth is so profound that sometimes, despite reading or listening to the statements of the divinely appointed imams, we are still left amazed and bewildered, for we truly do not understand the depths of what is being said. But we do understand that Imam Al-Jawad alayhi salam has taught us that according to Tawheed and Islamic monotheism, Allah is indivisible. Allah is the all-powerful, Allah is the all-aware, and all negative attributes and qualities are far away from Allah, and it is Allah who is the one and only God. This is Dialogue, Imam Al-Jawad alayhi salam.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.com.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
And now we invite you to listen to Sayyid Muhammad Ridhvi.
From our imams, the ninth imam is the first, whose imamat began at a very young age, about 8 or 9 years old. Basically, look at the special wisdom that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has given to our ninth imam. What is zinat? Beauty. But let us go to the hadith of the imam, where imam talks about a zinat in a very different level. Al-afaf. Zinatul Faqr. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, you know, people go through different phases in life. People are tested in different ways. And one of the situations that many people would face is poverty, faqr. But even in being poor, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, look for the beauty in poverty. And what is that? Al-afaf. Al-afaf basically can be translated as contentment. Contentment is the beauty for poverty. And if you look at this concept, you will see that, you know, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, even if He restrains the circumstances of a person on a financial economic level, that is also a way of test and trial for that person. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala would like to see, is there afaf there or not? And what is afaf? It means to live within our own means and not to give in to the desires so that we will be tempted to go and seek the means which are haram. And this is something, you know, praised by the Imam, where he says, Al-afaf zinatul faqr. If a person is faqir, he is in need, but he is able to content himself, you know, live within the means of his resources and not do things which are haram, then that is itself a zenith for him.
Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com/en, Call of Islam page, where you can find all of our previous programs and many others as well. Until another episode, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
In the limelight.
The United States is the only large, wealthy country in the world that doesn't have universal health care. The U.S. healthcare system ranks last among high-income countries. And the bad news comes when the media announces yet another drop in life expectancy in the United States for the second year in a row, which should be blamed mostly for the poor healthcare system in this country. In this regard, we have taken a look at the world media for further details on this issue. The title of the article is, "The U.S. Experiences Drop in life expectancy for second year in a row." Stay tuned, please. Truthout website recently wrote, "Life expectancy in the United States has dropped for the second year in a row, a decline that is largely due to the coronavirus pandemic and the country's inequitable healthcare system. Before the pandemic, the average life expectancy in the U.S. was 78 years and 10 months. In 2020, that number dropped to 77 years, and last year, it dropped to 76 years and 1 month. The last time the nation's life expectancy was this low was more than two decades ago, in 1996. The current drop is the largest two-year decline in the U.S. in almost 100 years of tracking the data. The life expectancy for members of marginalized communities has undergone a particularly precipitous drop. Over the past 2 years, the life expectancy for Native Americans and Alaska Natives dropped by around 6.6 years. It's a ridiculous decline. When I saw a 6.6-year decline over 2 years, my jaw dropped. I made my staff rerun the numbers to make sure," said Robert Anderson, chief of Mortality Statistics Branch of the National Center for Health Statistics. The life expectancy for Native Americans and Alaska Natives is now just 65 years, according to the new numbers. This figure is equivalent to the nation's life expectancy overall in 1940s. We'll be right back. According to the Truth Out, these numbers were released in a government report recently which cited the pandemic as the central reason for the decline. But experts say additional factors played a role as other wealthy nations have not seen the same drops, and some have begun to see their life expectancies recover from declines brought on by the pandemic. Stephen Wolf, Director Emeritus of Center on Society and Health at Virginia Commonwealth University, attributes the discrepancy to the fact that other countries have had more effective vaccination campaigns and populations that are more willing to social distance and wear masks. The U.S. healthcare system has also contributed to the decline, he said. While the U.S. is a world leader in terms of what kind of care it can provide, there are widespread socioeconomic disparities that make access to care more difficult, particularly for marginalized communities. Wolf said to the New York Times, "The United States is clearly an outlier. Notably, the U.S. is the only large wealthy country in the world without universal healthcare." And New York Times had this headline, U.S. life expectancy falls again in historic setback. It wrote, the decline during the pandemic is the sharpest in nearly 100 years, hitting Native American and Alaska Native communities particularly hard. The average life expectancy of Americans fell precipitously in 2020 and 2021, the sharpest two-year decline in nearly 100 years, and a stark reminder of the toll exacted on the nation by the continuing coronavirus pandemic. In 2021, the average American could expect to live until the age of 76. Federal health researchers reported recently the figure represents a loss of almost 3 years since 2019, when Americans could expect to live on average nearly 79 years. The reduction has been particularly steep among Native Americans and Alaska Natives, the National Center for Health Statistics reported. Average life expectancy in those groups was shortened by 4 years in 2020 alone. The culminative decline since the pandemic started, more than 6.5 years on average, has brought life expectancy to 65 among Native Americans and Alaska Natives, on par with the figure for all Americans in 1944. In 2021, the shortening of lifespan was more pronounced among white Americans than among black Americans, who saw greater reductions in the first year of the pandemic. According to New York Times, while the pandemic has driven most of the decline in life expectancy, a rise in accidental deaths and drug overdoses also contributed, as did deaths from heart disease, chronic liver disease, and diabetes. This is, until now, experts have been accustomed to measuring life expectancy changes in increments of months, not years. Even small declines in life expectancy of a tenth or two-tenths of a year mean that, on a population level, a lot more people are dying prematurely than they really should be, said Robert Anderson, chief of mortality statistics at the NCHS. But the coronavirus was not solely to blame. Long-standing health problems rooted in poverty, discrimination, and poor access to healthcare left Native Americans and Alaska Natives particularly vulnerable to the virus, said Dr. Ann Bullock, former director of diabetes treatment and prevention at the Federal Indian Health Service Agency and a member of the Minnesota Chippewa tribe. New York Times says one in seven Native Americans and Alaska Natives has diabetes, the highest rate among racial or ethnic groups in the United States of America, and many struggle with obesity or excess weight. Both conditions make people more susceptible to severe COVID-19 and crowded, multi-generational housing adds to the risk. Americans suffer from what experts have called the U.S. health disadvantage, an amalgam of influences that erode well-being, Dr. Wolf said. These include a fragmented, profit-driven healthcare system, poor diet, and a lack of physical activity, and pervasive risk factors such as smoking, widespread access to guns, poverty, and pollution. The problems are compounded for marginalized groups by racism and segregation, he added. The result is a high disease burden among Americans and shorter life expectancy compared with that in comparable high-income nations over the last two decades, Dr. Wolf said. Over a million Americans have died of COVID-19 and more died in 2021 than in 2020. Despite the availability of vaccines, to date, only 2/3 of Americans are fully vaccinated and only 1/3 have had a booster shot.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Iruba Shavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Said Pureza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Said Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
On Wednesday, Italy's largest retailers association, Confcommercio, warned that over 120,000 small businesses risk shutting down in the first half of 2023. The association said firms are squeezed by the cost of living and skyrocketing energy prices. The president of Confcommercio, Carlo Sangalli, urged the government to do more to shield small and medium entrepreneurs, as the situation for many is now very critical.
There is the risk of a high number of business closures in the coming 9 months. Some small firms will simply find it more convenient to suspend their activity rather than losing 200 to 300 euros a day. Having said that, Italy will soon face a mild recession, which frankly is not as worrying as the media depict it.
Last month, Italy's outgoing government approved an aid package worth some 14 billion euros in an attempt to shield firms and families from surging energy costs. The measure came on top of over 50 billion euros already budgeted since January to soften the energy crisis in the country. However, the aid seems to be insufficient as an increasing number of businesses are struggling to stay afloat.
Everything costs at least 20% more. Energy prices keep soaring and it is very hard to keep going. We need help. The government must do something.
I cannot afford paying expenses for my family. I have four dependent children. They're all unemployed. Bills keep going up. How do we cope?
According to Confcommercio, more than 370,000 jobs are at risk as a result of the energy crisis. Meanwhile, energy giant Eni announced that gas supplies to Italy from Russia have resumed after 4 days. Russia's state-controlled Gazprom cut off gas supplies to Italy on Saturday, citing a problem linked to regulatory changes in Austria. Italy's national energy regulator, ARERA, warned last week that prices would climb by almost 60% by the end of the year, but experts argue that its estimate was optimistic. Bills have risen by 93% in Italy over the past 2 years, and the conflict between Russia and Ukraine, together with the damage recently sustained by Nord Stream pipelines, is likely to push costs even higher. Max Civili, Rome.
Back on October 3, 2015, this Doctors Without Borders hospital in Kunduz was reduced to rubble after being hit by a U.S. deadly airstrike. 211 shells were fired in the strike, lasting almost 1 hour. The charity hospital later announced that 42 civilians, including staffers and patients, were killed, and dozens of others were wounded.
Throughout the NATO coalition presence in Afghanistan, there were a lot of blind airstrikes and rights violations against Afghan civilians, especially by American air forces. The 2015 attack on Kunduz Charity Hospital was one of those atrocities and the biggest of its kind. As I remember, it was so deadly and devastating. Hospitals in war zones are protected under the 4th Geneva Convention, and attacks on them should be tried as a war crime.
After initially denying the building being targeted, the U.S. eventually claimed responsibility for the airstrikes, justifying that it had been a serious and tragic mistake.
Independently and impartially.
The MSF called it a breach of international humanitarian law and a war crime, demanding for an independent probe. But an independent investigation or trial has never been conducted against the U.S. forces' atrocities.
The MSF and rights bodies believe that the U.S. deadly air raid on Charity Hospital could be prosecuted as a war crime, but the international courts and bodies failed to conduct a trial because they are controlled by arrogant powers. They are funded by those countries and obey them. Besides, the U.S. has never agreed to turn any of their service members over to an outside judicial body. As a result, the case of the Kunduz attack was shot by Washington with a mere discipline of some American personnel, and no one was criminally charged.
Throughout the two-decade U.S. invasion of Afghanistan, there had been more than 13,000 airstrikes conducted by American forces in the country. The U.S. drone war on Afghanistan killed more than 4,000 people, including women and children. The U.S. airstrike on the Charity Hospital in Kunduz is one of the many instances of American forces' atrocities on Afghan soil. People here say the U.S. should be held accountable for crimes it has committed in Afghanistan. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Muslims in London were compelled to mobilize outside an Islamic center on Saturday following recent Islamophobic violence by anti-Iran protesters. On Sunday, the 25th of September, London witnessed an outpouring of anti-Muslim attacks as protesters claiming to support Mirza Amini were filmed attacking Shia Muslims commemorating Arba'in and the Iranian Islamic Center of England, following clashes with police outside Iran's embassy.
Last week, our mosque was attacked. Our procession was attacked. People were attacked that weren't even Iranian, had nothing, they didn't know anything about what was going on. And it impedes our freedom of religion in this country.
Protests over the death of Amini, a 22-year-old Iranian woman who fell to the floor at a police station on September the 16th, started shortly after her death was announced. Those protests soon turned into violent riots, with masked people attacking security officers, resorting to vandalism, and desecrating religious sanctities, including hijab burnings. Dissident groups outside of Iran were quick to board the bandwagon, engaging in violent protests throughout Europe, especially in London and Paris.
We've got people not of an Iranian origin, but in fact of multinational origin who've come out here to direct their anger to these people who are loaded with anti-Islamic people, LGBT people, and all elements which are anti-Islam who've come out here to side with an event which has happened in Iran. But really, they don't care about that event.
A police presence remains outside the Islamic Center, that groups are continuing to target the site.
Saturday's demonstration passed by peacefully without any major incidents occurring. However, locals informed me that they remained deeply concerned that future attacks may take place. They also informed me that they were deeply frustrated at the local authorities who failed to protect the community. Robert Carter, London.
For the first time in a decade, a meeting of the EU-Israel Association Council has taken place to discuss issues such as the conflict in Ukraine, the energy crisis, and cooperation in the areas of trade and climate change.
Is there any common ground between Israel and the EU on the issue of the Iran nuclear deal?
Well, this is one of the issues in which certainly we disagree. And Prime Minister Lapid has been very vocal in expressing his disagreement with this process. But I have a mandate from the United Nations, and that's what I'm trying to do. By the time being, in any case, the negotiations are stalled.
Palestinian rights campaigners gathered outside the European Council building in Brussels, where the EU-Israel meeting was taking place. They asked, why is this suddenly happening after a 10-year break?
It's a good question. Why do we want to resume it now? Because we need the gas, or what is the reason? Even though, actually, the apartheid policy that Israel is implementing is increasing and is worsening every day. They're colonizing more, building more settlements.
Israeli army killed Palestinian guys and children every day. They steal homes in Jerusalem and West Bank. They expand their illegal settlements.
We see the EU as a colonial institution supporting and funding the existence of the settlements and the Israeli Zionist colony inside Palestine and over the rights of the Palestinian people.
It's perhaps noteworthy that there was no press conference following the EU-Israel Association Council. Therefore, journalists were unable to ask questions. Prior to this meeting, Human Rights Watch released a statement which says, instead of reciting empty platitudes, European officials should use the Association Council to finally condemn Israel's apartheid and persecution and make clear there will be meaningful consequences should the Israeli government not reverse course. Of course, this statement was ignored. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Energy, housing, and soaring prices across the board. Britain's cost of living crisis is worsening and people are suffering. Giovanni and his wife are two of over 1,000 protesters greeting the Conservative Party conference here in Birmingham.
They don't care about ordinary people. They just want to hold on to power and maximise their own purses and get as much money out for themselves as they possibly can. It's despicable.
Conservative Prime Minister Liz Truss's government has nailed its colors to the mast. Tax cuts favoring the rich, business enterprise zones, and billions to slow the rise of household energy bills, which have gone up again this week. But all of it uncosted, sending the markets into a meltdown. How will British taxpayers afford it?
People are absolutely terrified about what's going to happen to their mortgages. They're terrified about their energy bills. They're terrified about, generally, the cost of living. And yet, at the same time, for those on over £150,000 a year, they're going to get much better off as a result of this.
The PM has pledged her government will keep an iron grip on national finances as part of her commitment to sound money. The subtext, looming cuts to already struggling public services.
They always say that we've got to pay the price for their problems. They created these problems. They create the wars, they create the